Al will be forever the myth.
You're the king of kings, though.
There's always a pecking order. The little peckers never mess with the big peckers. So I'm a rooster, and he's a chicken.
This episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast is brought to you by our sponsor, Florida Alternative Medicine. All right, welcome everybody to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, where we talk to the legends of bodybuilding and we also talk about the history of bodybuilding. I'm your host, John Hansen. And on today's show, we are going to have an interview with Annabelle Lopez, who is a former WBBG Mr. America, and also Bill Nealon, who is a Florida resident, and Bill is a judge and a competitor out here in the Florida area. And they're going to talk to us about their visit with Chris Dickerson, which was about a week or 2 weeks ago. And I wanted to go visit with him. So Annabelle, who is a longtime friend of Chris, got together as many people as he could, and they kind of surprised Chris, and they went to the nursing home that Chris is at, and they had a little visit with him. So I thought, what a better way to learn about that visit than talk to Annabelle and Bill Nealon himself. Talk to both of these guys and learn about the visit from both of them. Bill is a longtime friend of Chris. He's probably one of Chris's best friends in the Florida area. So it was great to talk to both of those guys. So that'll be coming up in a minute. Before we get to that, I wanted to mention our sponsor, who is Florida Alternative Medicine, where age is just a number. If you want to feel great, optimize your energy levels, burn fat, and balance your hormone levels to maximize your potential, then go see the experts at Florida Alternative Medicine and Weight Loss. They have a certified and knowledgeable staff that will work with you to achieve your goals and get you the results you've been looking for. They offer a wide range of services that ensure you will not only look and feel amazing, but also be comfortable knowing that they're there for you every step of the way. Their competitive pricing, along with their quality products and services, are just a few reasons to give them a call. So call them at their office number in Tampa, Florida, 813-922-8939, or you can just go to their website, which is flalternativemeds.com. Again, that's flalternativemeds.com. They have offices all over the United States, but they can work with anybody in the continental United States just through their website. Tell them that you heard their ad on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, and they'll give you a free consultation. Plus, they'll give you 20% off your first order. All right, we missed the show last week. I had quite a busy schedule this month. June is like super busy for me. I had a 3-day class that I had to take from work, and that ended up taking a lot of my time. And then I ended up getting a head cold after that. So I just couldn't get an interview scheduled for that week. So we missed last week's show, but we're back, and I'm trying to get some interviews set up for this month. I haven't had any yet. So cross your fingers and hopefully I can get some interviews set up for this coming month for the next few weeks. I did talk to Lee Haney last week, and I told him I wanted to have him and Robbie Robinson on the show because Lee just did an interview with Robbie, who was his idol growing up, and I think he did it on his Instagram page. So I told Lee it'd be cool if we could have both of them back on the show, so I'm trying to arrange that. Robbie's always tough to get a hold of, so I don't know if that's going to go through or not, but I'm sure Lee will come back on the show, and maybe we could get him with someone else. So I got a few other things I'm working on. A lot of these guys just don't respond. It's really, really hard to get some of these guys to do interviews. I don't know why. So anyways, I'll be working on that and keep your fingers crossed. Hopefully we'll have an interview for next week. At the end of today's interview, after we talk to Annabelle and Bill, I am going to read one of the best and most famous articles in the bodybuilding history. This is Jack Neary's report of the 1980 Mr. Olympia contest, and it comes from the February 1981 issue of Muscle and Fitness magazine. And for those of us who were around back in bodybuilding back in the day, way before the internet started, we got all of our information from the magazine. So I'll never forget hearing the story about Arnold winning the Mr. Olympia, but we didn't know all the details. And it was Jack Neary's article that really brought it to fruition and really was the first insight into how controversial this show was and how Arnold really looked and how the other competitors looked and all the behind-the-scenes action that was going on. So this is really a great article, and I thank Pat Comer, one of our friends of the show, for sending me this article. I had it in one of my old magazines, but I don't have the magazine here available with me in Florida. So thanks to Pat for sending that to me, and I haven't read it in a long time. It was really enjoyable reading it again. So I'm going to share that article with you as soon as our interview with Annabelle and Bill is over with. All right. So what else is going on? I got some emails I'm going to read in a second. I had a few birthdays last month that I didn't mention. Let's see. Ronnie Coleman turned 57 years old on May 13th. So happy birthday to Ronnie. Hopefully he's doing better with all his injuries. I see some of his videos on YouTube. I guess he got some stem cell treatments to take care of the back pain that he's going through. So we'll see if that goes through. Hopefully Ronnie will get back to the gym. I know he'd love that. He's still going to the gym anyways. Rich Gaspari turned 58 years old on May 16th. Rich is my age. We were born in the same year, 1963. And Robbie himself, Robbie Robinson, just turned 75 years old on May 24th. So happy birthday to Robbie Robinson. He is looking still fantastic. Seems like yesterday I was at the 2001 Mr. Olympia, and I saw Robbie working a booth. And I took a picture with him. I convinced him to flex his arm, and I did a like an idiot. I took an arm pose with Robbie. And I remember Robbie was 55 years old that day or that year because I asked him how old he was, and he said he was double nickel, 55. So that was 20 years ago. I can't believe it. Now Robbie is 75, but he's still training hard and he's still looking good. So happy birthday to all those guys. I know we got some big birthdays coming up in June too, so I'll mention those when they happen. All right, let's read some of these emails that I got from you guys the last couple of weeks. If you guys want to email me, you can just do that at naturalolympia@gmail.com. I always enjoy hearing from you guys. All right, this one was from Mike. He said, "Hi, John. I just finished listening to the Ron Love interview. I enjoyed it so much. What a nice guy. I could have listened to him talk and laugh all day. I remember him as a competitor, but never the person behind the awesome physique. Thank you for a great interview. It's good to hear another great example of a champion from that era doing so well today as a result of living the true and healthy bodybuilding lifestyle and loving life. I wrote you a few months back saying all the gyms were still closed in England. They opened a month ago, and it's a joy to be able to train again. Take care, John. Best wishes, Mike." All right. Thank you, Mike. I'm glad you're able to work out again. That must have been hell not working out for that long. That's crazy. This one says, "Greetings, John. I hope this email finds you well. I've recently stumbled upon your podcast, and I just have to say it is excellent. The golden era was before my time. I'm 33 years old, but it remains the most interesting and entertaining era of the sport. It was great to hear all about Ron Love, who I hadn't heard of before. I especially enjoyed your conversations with Danny Padilla, as I'm from Rochester as well. I look forward to catching up on all the old shows and catching all the new ones. Stay healthy. Noah A." All right. Thank you, Noah. Welcome to the show. Glad you're enjoying it. Just go to the website, bodybuildinglegendsshow.com, and click on the podcast link, and you will get all of our old podcasts up there. We have all of them since we started almost 4 years ago. Can you believe we're coming up on our four-year anniversary? July 5th will be the fourth-year anniversary of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. So we'll have to plan a couple special episodes, maybe do a couple old reviews of some of my favorite shows. We did that a couple years ago, so I'll do that again this year. So that's like about 1 month away. All right, and then I know you guys have been asking me to get Mohammed Makawi on the show, and I told you I've been contacting him for the last, probably the last couple of years, asking him to come on the podcast. And somebody said he has an Instagram account now, and he also has a YouTube page, and he's demonstrating exercises on there. So I thought maybe he's ready now to come on and do an interview since he is on social media and he is promoting himself. So I wrote to Mohammed, and Mohammed wrote me back, and this is what he said. He said, "Hi, John, thank you for the offer. I do not give any interviews or podcasts. If my fans want to know something extra from me, they can visit my Instagram or YouTube. Thank you, Mohammed." So there you go. Mohammed is not interested in doing any interviews. Unfortunately for us fans, we would love to hear from him, but that's the way it goes. Speaking of YouTube, if you guys check out my YouTube page, I do have part one of our interview that I did with Jerry Branham, Tom Terwilliger, and Phil Williams, where we went over the mandatory poses and we picked who looked the best in the golden era of bodybuilding and all the mandatory poses. And part two will be coming up this week. It takes a lot of editing to put all those pictures in, and I even put some video clips in. So I'm almost done with part two, so that'll be up this week. So check out my YouTube page if you haven't checked that out yet. It's under my name, John Hansen. And I also put some other videos up. I got some old videos from the 1988 Pro USA Championships, which was held in Anaheim, California. Mike Glass was the promoter. Mike Christian won that contest over Brian Buchanan, who was making his pro debut in the IFBB. He was in the NABBA before that. And Mike Quinn was in the show, and Scott Wilson, and Robbie looked fantastic. Robbie was making a comeback in the IFBB, or he was in the middle of his comeback, which I think started in 87, and he looked fantastic. So I've got Mike Quinn's posing routine up there, and I've got the interview section where Sean Ray interviewed a lot of the competitors. So that's really cool. So check that out. I've also got some clips from our Jack Neary interview and our Danny Padilla interview up there. So check out my YouTube page when you get a chance. And like I said, I'll be putting more stuff up there this week, including part two of our interview with Tom Terwilliger, Jerry Branum, and Phil Williams, which I really enjoyed doing those interviews with those guys. That was a lot of fun. I was on Dave Palumbo's show this week, if you didn't get a chance to check that out. He has a show called Guru Talk, and he talks to people who are adept at helping people get ready for contests and things like that. And me and Dave had a talk about how to build muscle naturally. And I suggested this to Dave because I see all the time now on the internet, all these kids, it seems like they don't believe you can build any muscle at all without taking steroids, because steroids are such a big topic in social media now. And everybody talks about steroids and everybody talks about what they're taking. And I think a lot of these young guys getting into the sport think they believe that in order to build any muscle at all, you have to use steroids. So I thought me and Dave could have a talk about how to build muscle naturally. And I talked about how I went from 135 pounds when I started at 14 years old to 230 pounds at 21 years old without taking any steroids. So I talked about my training, my nutrition, and how that all worked. So that's really interesting. It's getting a lot of hits. A lot of people are watching it. And I read the comments underneath the video, and a lot of people really liked it. It's really positive. So check that out on RX Muscle on YouTube, and you'll see that. All right. So I think that's all I got for opening. Here is our kind of a short interview with Annabelle Lopez and Bill Nealon. And we talk about the meeting they had with Chris Dickerson. And stay tuned right after the interview, because I'm going to be reading Jack Neary's article about the 1980 Mr. Olympia. Here we go. All right. Welcome back to the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. I have two special guests with me this week. Mr. Annabelle Lopez, who was the WBBG Mr. America winner. And we also have Bill Nealon, who is a judge and a competitor in the Florida area. And both Annabelle and Bill and a bunch of other people got together last weekend to meet with Chris Dickerson out in Fort Lauderdale. Chris is in a nursing home out there. And Annabelle organized a trip to go out there. And so I thought I'd have him on the show to talk about it. Welcome to the show, guys.
Great to see you, John.
All right. Well, Annabelle, let's start with you, because you're the one who organized this trip. You got a bunch of guys to go out to visit Chris in the nursing home. So before we talk about your trip, though, let's bring our listeners up to date on what happened with Chris about a year ago, right? A year ago, Chris was brought into the nursing home?
Correct, yeah.
So what happened, Annabelle? He fell down. Did he break his hip? And then when he got to the hospital, he had a heart attack there?
Yeah, Chris has been having different issues, and Bill Nealon, you know, he's pretty much up to date of what happened to him. I believe that he fell, right, Bill?
Yes, he fell and broke his hip.
And broke his hip, yeah.
So then what happened, Bill, when they brought him to the hospital, then Chris had more complications?
Yeah, they went to do major surgery, a hip replacement surgery, and Chris suffered a major heart attack while under anesthesia.
Wow, okay.
So he was on a ventilator for 17 days. Chris also caught COVID while he was there at the rehab center. So it was real touch and go for a while, and they were worried about brain damage because he was on the ventilator so long.
Okay.
And from what I understood, when they tried to pull him off the ventilator, he really panicked, and the brain didn't want to let go of that artificial breathing, and that's why they were worried about brain damage, because he didn't breathe on his own when they tried to take him off the ventilator. So it was pretty scary, but he did make a full recovery.
Did they have to put him on the ventilator because of the COVID, or was it because of the heart attack?
I think the heart attack. And then later on, subsequently, he got COVID. I think his resistance was so down
yeah,
that right, he yeah. was so susceptible he caught COVID, yes.
Okay.
But the ventilator was a result of the heart attack.
Okay. Yeah, a lot of elderly people caught COVID in those nursing homes, right? That was like a big place to catch it, you know?
Yes, they did, yeah.
How did Chris recover okay from the COVID? What, did he get back from that okay?
He did. Back from COVID, he did, yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. But it left him 2 weeks to do any physical therapy or rehab on his hip. He was too weak.
Okay. So then they decided to just keep him in the nursing home, right? Because he wouldn't have been able to take care of himself because Chris lives by himself.
Right. He needed round-the-clock care.
Okay. Gotcha. Now, what's the prognosis for Chris? Are they going to let him out of the nursing home eventually, or do you think he'll have to stay in there?
Do I take that one on about?
Yeah, we really don't know what's going to happen with Chris yet. But the day of this visit, he had recovered pretty good. He looked very, very alert and looked good, right, Bill?
Yeah.
Yes, that's the best I've seen him. He looked robust and pretty healthy, yes.
Okay. So who did you get to go up to visit him, Annabelle? You've got a bunch of people to go up there.
Well, I probably could have gotten a full house if I would have, you know, promoted, you know.
Yeah.
If I would have promoted this, I would have gone crazy because I know how people love Chris and people are always writing to me and asking me how he's doing, asking him for the address. And one thing that that Chris told me one time when at the beginning of this situation was that he didn't want to publicize anything. And that's why I never wrote anything about it, you know. But I went ahead and I did listen to him. But this time I decided to, after my last visit before this one, I was only able to speak to him through the window of his room. You know, they didn't allow us to go in.
Okay.
And I believe Bill had to do the same thing. And after that time, I was very concerned about Chris. He really didn't look good. He was not responding like himself. He was laying on a bed, wouldn't get up. And so that concerned me a lot. And I saw him very, very down, you know. And I even asked him if I could take a picture of him, you know, laying on the bed and then waving at the people. And he did it. And I kind of sensed that he needed assurance, you know, that he's not forgotten. And because I told him, I said, look, a lot of people are asking me about you. They're writing to me. And I'd like to get your permission, you know, to publish this picture, which I did not publish. I didn't want to show him in a, you know, laying on a bed there or cover up, you know. Mm-hmm. So after that day, I gave it some thought. And I spoke with Bill Nealon since he's, you know, he's the closest one to him and the one that's he's able to get to him in no time at all. And I discussed with him the idea of putting a group together in that if I was able to get the right people there, it will help him a lot. I did not discuss this with Chris. We surprised him with this visit. And I invited, let's see, who was there? You could help me along, Bill.
Sure. Andy Bustinto was there. Adolfo Bustinto Robles. Andy and his wife.
Right.
Andy Bustinto and his wife. Adolfo.
Right.
Peter
Adolfo
Potter.
Robles. Yeah.
Peter Potter.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And your wife and mother-in-law and myself.
Okay.
That's correct. The reason I did this, John, is because I just didn't want to get the wrong people there and make a mess out of it. Besides, I was the nursing home told me that I could, you know, about keeping the group limited to who's going to be there. And I wanted to kind of obey that. But my whole purpose of this meeting with Chris and surprising him was to look for a way to, you know, build up his spirit. And I think we did that, right, Bill? He was really very responsive.
Very much.
He connected with us. He interacted in the conversation and answered the questions. And we had fun. I have to say, we had fun.
Yeah, yeah. I saw the video that you put on Facebook, and I was surprised. Chris was very, very with it. He didn't seem like he was, you know, like old or decrepit or anything like that. I mean, he seemed like himself. You know.
Yes.
He was cracking jokes.
Yeah, that's right. You know, and you know, we discussed that. We talked a little bit our past, you know, when I was training with him and the things I learned from him. But what I really liked what the nursing home did, we met outside, and when we walked in, his back was towards us. I think he was only expecting me to be there.
Mm-hmm.
Because they told him that, you know, that I wasn't gonna be the one. And when he turned around and he saw all these people walking there, he was like really surprised, right, Bill?
Yeah.
Yes. It was great.
Yeah, yeah. So he
like
felt good.
The greatest thing we could do for him, Annabelle. That was the greatest thing you could do for him.
Yeah.
To lift his spirits, you know?
Yeah. I kind of thought about it. I meditated about it. I said, wow, I think I'm gonna do this. There's, you know, we have a problem nowadays that people want to celebrate you after you pass away, you know? I says, I don't want, you know, hey, there's a song that says, love me and give me what you got to give me while I'm alive.
Right, exactly.
Right. Yeah. So I think it worked out really good. I'm glad I did it. I came back with a good feeling, and I think everybody else did too.
Yeah.
And at the same time, it was good to see, you know, the other people there that I have not seen for years and years, you know?
Yeah.
So
yeah. Now, in addition to you guys, you also had some letters that you brought with, right? From people who wrote letters to them?
Yes. Yes. I contacted Lee Haney, Boya Coe, Richard Baldwin. Yes, he wanted to come over, but, you know, at the last minute, he had a family situation that he had to take care of.
Okay.
And he sent me a letter, and another friend of his from India sent me letters. And he was really surprised with those letters as I read them. So, and, it, you know, all this came together because these are people that he knows, and they send them great letters. You know, they were very, very well put together. And he felt very touched, and a lot of time, you know, he became emotional, you know.
Sure.
And I had those parts on video, but I didn't want to show him like that, you know, all broken down, you know.
Yeah.
So that was more personal there, and I didn't want the whole world watching that, you know.
Okay. And Bill, me and you were just talking before we started the interview about Boyer and Chris, how far they go back, right?
Oh yeah,
yeah, yeah.
Boyer Coe mentioned that in the letter that he sent them, you know?
Yes. Boyer mentioned to Chris in the letter that he remembered the night they met, and it was when Boyer won the Teenage Mr. America in 1966. Chris was there, and Boyer wanted to meet Chris, and that's when they met. They became great friends after that for years, and they went back and forth. I think I looked it up, and I think Chris beat Boyer 11 times, and I think Boyer beat Chris 6 or 7 times.
Wow.
Yeah.
Boyer wrote a little nice letter. I could read it to you if you want. I
mean, yeah,
it's very
interesting.
Boyer Coe says to Chris, you and I go back a long way. I recall first meeting you way back in 1966, right after the Teenage Mr. America that I was in. You were with our good friend Dennis and Joe Abenda, and I believe Dick Chattel was there as well. Dick Chattel was a fellow that I don't know if you know of him, John. He used to, you know, come around with us, and he judged a few times, but he was more of a follower of the sport, and he was a very nice person.
Okay.
So anyway, the letter, he says, many great times enjoying your friendship and all the competition we were in. We both became lifelong friends with Bill Pearl and, of course, Cliff Swan, one of the best physique photographers ever. Chris, I wish I could be there in person with all the other great guys who are getting together to honor you. It has always been a pleasure to call you my friend, and I wish you the very best. God bless you. Boyer Coe.
Wow, that's great. Yeah. Yeah, I was going to say the same thing as you, Bill. I mean, if anybody who knows bodybuilding, if you go back over history, you could go back to the 60s when these guys were amateurs and they were competing against
men.
And I think Boyer was ahead of them. But then when Chris turned pro, And even in NABBA, remember they were going to NABBA together? They were competing over there.
Yes. Yeah. Both of them.
Yeah. Then they became
like, they're on the stage together. Yeah, they're on the stage together.
Yeah.
When Boyer won the professional, Chris won the amateur.
Right.
73.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Chris and I, you know, we go way back before we, you know, we start, you know, before I started competing. You know, and Chris as well, you know, he had not won any big titles, and we were, you know, training together, and he helped me. I owe Chris a lot.
Yeah.
You know, he got my first picture in the magazine. He wrote the first article introducing me in the magazines. And we, you know, Chris became more like part of my family, you know, my mother, my father, my brothers and sister, they all knew Chris well because he used to come over the house a lot at the times that we were training together. And he became part of our family.
Yeah.
So I have always had a very close relationship with him. And after all these things that happened to him, I just don't forget. I don't forget people that do things for me and help me out.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not going to forget Bill for helping me out with this meeting.
Yeah, and Chris started, helped you get training, helped you started training when you were. You
guys Yeah. We trained together, and the posing that I know, I owe it to Chris. He taught me how to pose, and it's funny that you know, the day of the meeting we were talking about it, and you know what he always told me advice about posing, what to do, what not to do, and I carried it through, you know.
Yeah.
We got a kick out of that, right, Bill? Because I said that nowadays the guys, they pose too much, you know. And Chris always said to me, when you are competing, the more you pose, the more you show your weaknesses. I always remember that. He said, you should not, you know, for competition, for prejudging, for judging, you should not do more than 10 poses. Mm. And I never forget about that. You know, and I think it's correct, because I see guys nowadays, you know, I don't go to contests much, but the times that I've been, you can't do that. You know, you can't continue to pose. We used to take pictures of ourselves, and then out of those pictures, I will make my posing routine, because that's the way he learned. He learned that from Bill Pearl, so he used to pass it on to me.
Mm. So you look at the pictures and see which ones you look the best in. And say, okay,
yeah. We all have favorite poses. And I think that from all the pictures that we take, the one that, you know, displays our physique the best, those are the ones you incorporate into the prejudging or the selection of body parts and things like that. But now, if you're doing a posing exhibition, then that's a different situation. You could do whatever, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Now, did Chris work with you a lot on the transitions and stuff? Because he was such a great poser for his time.
Oh, yeah. We used to spend an hour to sometimes 2 hours posing.
Yeah, every day.
Yep. And the posing was harder than the training.
Yeah, right.
You know, posing is great because, it, all the tensing and all that helps you, you know, bring out your definition as well.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely.
But the secret behind the posing is that the more you practice, you got to have it in your mind. There's nothing worse than standing in front of an audience and not knowing what you're going to do next.
Right.
You should flow through your poses, one pose to the other, you know?
Right. Now, Bill, you've known Chris a real long time. You're one of his closest friends. How did you guys ever meet? How did that all start?
In fact, I told that story at Well, we were at the meeting. I was at the 2003 Nationals with my friend Mike Brooks, and we didn't realize, we thought the morning tickets were good for the night show also, but they were not. So I told Mike, wait here that evening, and I'd go get the tickets at the box office. And there were that lobby there at the Jackie Gleason Theater was so packed, so crowded, that coming back to where Mike was, I actually had to walk sideways, because there were so many people.
Right.
And I'm coming, walking sideways, and a guy's trying to pass me, and I look directly into the eyes of Chris Dickerson. Now, you got to remember, John, this guy all my life was just images in the magazine.
Right.
I saw videos of Chris, but I had hardly heard his voice. I never saw him really move. the man is standing in front of me. So I stopped right where I was, and I stopped him, and I said, "You're Chris Dickerson." And he looked at me, and he agreed. And then I proceeded to tell him more about himself than he knew. And I said to him, "I know something about you that very few people know." And he's blinking at me. And I said, "When you were 16, your vocal coach told you you needed to lift weights to increase your lung capacity and your rib cage for your opera singing." Wow. And Chris looked at me, and he backed his head up and said, "How do you know that?" I said, "Because, Chris, it was in an Ebony magazine in 1970, and I bought that Ebony magazine." And Chris looked at me and said, "That was 33 years ago." I said, "Yes, Chris, that's the kind of impact you had on me. When I saw Chris in the magazines, I stopped turning the pages because I couldn't relate to Dave Draper or Arnold. They were too big, but Chris was about my height." Mm. And I looked at him and I said, "You know, maybe if I really train my butt off for 10 years, I can approach something like that." Yeah. You know? And and I had pictures of him and Boyer and Frank Zane on my wall in high school. And my parents, for this, you know, 1970, you know, 69, my parents would come in my bedroom and, you know, "What's with our son and these half-naked men on the walls? Why not a football player? Why not a baseball player, son?" I said, "Because I want to be like that, Mom. I want to look like that." And they just shook their heads, you know. They couldn't understand why their son wanted to oil up his body and shave the hair off his legs and do this crazy vain thing. But, you know, as you know, John and Annabelle, we'd buy magazines. And Annabelle was in the magazines, Muscular Development, Strength and Health, and MTI. And we'd get these magazines and read about these stars and what they were doing and how they were doing it. And we'd follow their routines. And we'd read the articles. And you may remember, way before the internet or any of those things, we had to wait till the issues came out to find out who won the Mr. America, won the Mr. Universe. And it would be months later, later, before we could find out.
Right.
But we lived for those magazines when they'd come to the newsstand.
Right.
But again, they were images. You never dreamed of meeting them. You know, meeting Chris Dickerson in the 70s was like meeting Bob Hope. You're not going to meet him. He's in California. You're not going to meet Frank Zane.
Right.
Now these guys are accessible. Well, flash forward 4 years, and I'm at this judging Peter Potter Southern States. Well, I said to Chris in 2003, I said, "Chris, if you're ever in Florida again," I said, "please, I have a personal training facility. I'd love to show it to you. Come by, and I'd love to. Please contact me." I gave him my business card. Well, 4 years later, I'm judging the Southern States, and right before intermission, I turn around and sitting in the VIPs in the front row right behind me is Chris Dickerson. Mm-hmm. And I turned around, it's 4 years later. I said, "Chris, I'm sure you don't remember me, but I met you 4 years ago at the Nationals in Miami." He pointed at me. He said, "I remember you, Ebony Magazine." I said, right, Chris. Mm-hmm. And I said, "Listen, can I take you to lunch?" And the next Saturday we went to lunch and we developed a tremendous friendship from then on.
Yeah. That's awesome.
That was it. Yeah.
And you guys stayed really, you've been really close to him all these years, right?
Yes. At that time, Chris, you know, he had several surgeries, his knees, his back, he had a shoulder surgery, and he really was kind of out of the circuit and out of the loop, you know? And I said, "Geez, we've got this legend right here in South Florida."
Yeah.
And I remember in February of 2008, well, before that, I tried to help Chris revive his career. And Annabelle, you'll remember this, when Chris had a seminar at Powerhouse Gym in West Palm Beach in January of 2008. Yeah. We put on a seminar. Right. Chris put on a terrific seminar. And then the next month in February of 2008, that was Black History Month. That particular year, they were celebrating Black firsts. And I contacted Tanya Knight, who's the news anchor here in West Palm Beach. I said, "You know, you've got a treasure right here in South Florida. Chris Dickerson is the first African-American, the first Black man to win the Mr. America title. He broke the color barrier in bodybuilding. And we've got him right here in Florida. Not only that, he's a full-time Mr. Universe, the oldest man to win the Mr. Olympia, and he's right here." She said, "Do you think he'd be willing to go on the news?" I said, I think I could talk him into it. I think so. And Chris went on the 11 o'clock news, and he was great. He's a great public speaker.
Yeah.
With such a resonant voice, and he was terrific, and he gave a great account of himself and about, you know, taking charge of opportunity, and he was just really great. And from there, I got him honored at several shows, John Schleicher's show in Tampa, and Peter Potter's show, Frank Dalto, and I, you know, was kind of making the rounds with Chris as a guest of honor. And a lot of people go to those shows then, John. When Chris won the Mr. Olympia, they were 5 years old.
Yeah.
You know, so I got a clip from YouTube of the top six of the 82 Olympia with Chris's routine on it and him getting awarded the Mr. Olympia. So I would show that, and then I would do like a 2-minute introduction to about Chris Dickerson and who he is and what he's done. And a lot of people don't know this about Chris. Chris was really the first personal trainer at Gold's Gym, Venice. He had a loft upstairs in the 80s. And he was a personal trainer at Gold's way before anybody was really doing that, way before Charles Glass or any of those guys. Chris was doing a personal training at Gold's, right, Annabelle? I know you remember that.
Yep. Yeah.
Yeah, he was doing personal training at Gold's not long after he won the Mr. America and all through the 80s. You know, most people don't realize he won a lot of couples championships, too.
Yeah, I remember that.
Mixed pairs. Yeah, yeah, he sure did.
Mm-hmm.
He had a 30-year career.
Yeah, yeah, which you don't see anymore in today's bodybuilders, right?
No, Boyer had a 30-year career.
Yeah.
I mean, there were lapses in there, but totally they competed 30 years.
I know. They started in the 60s, and they weren't done until the 90s.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, both of them finished, I think, at the Masters Olympia
in
94.
Yeah, that golden era of really something else.
There you have it, John. Anything you want to know about us, you could ask him.
Right. did Bill Pearl get a chance to write a letter, Annabelle?
He also wrote a letter, yes. Him and his wife Judy. I spoke to them on the phone, both of them. She mainly does, you know, most of his presentations and answerings, you know, and all that. And he wrote a really nice letter too. So it was nice, you know. Lee Haney wrote a letter as well. So
yeah.
It was nice. You know, I think Chris was very happy about that. And I'm very excited about that. I was able to do this for him because he deserves that and more.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, Annabelle, I think it touched Chris to get such respect from men of that caliber. To show their respect and love for Chris, men of that caliber and achievement in the sport who tipped their hat to Chris. I remember when Chris and I were at the 2010 Mr. Olympia, it was a 45th anniversary, and I got to go as Chris' guest. And we were at the expo in the morning, and we found Lee Haney, and Lee Haney grabs Chris around the shoulder, and he looks at me, and he points at Chris. He goes, "Now, this is a real champion."
Wow.
That's what Lee Haney said about Chris Dickerson. Yeah. Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Sure did.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, Lee Haney and I, we have actually never met in person, but we know each other, and he writes letters to me. And what I admire most about Lee is how respectful he is, how well mannered he is.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
And coming from a person like that to call me sir. And call me Mr. Lopez. I keep telling him, I said, when are you going to stop that? call him her. He says, no, you deserve that, you know. But, he is a real gentleman. He's a wonderful person.
Yeah. Yeah. Those guys who have a lot of class, they recognize past champions, you know, and they'll never forget them, and they always give them a certain reverence.
Yeah.
I remember when Lee competed against Sergio Oliva and the 1984 Mr. Olympia, and I interviewed Lee, and I said, "What did it feel like to beat Sergio Oliva?" He said, "Well, I didn't beat Sergio Oliva." He goes, "Sergio Oliva was there giving an appearance. He was giving an exhibition." He goes, "I was just honored to stand on stage with him."
Wow. Yeah. He's, you know, that's him.
Yeah.
That's him.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to tell you something before I forget. I want to thank you for allowing me to be on your show.
Oh, you will.
Because You have also done a lot for bodybuilding, and all these things that you do, you know, mean a lot to us, you know, and inviting me to be part of, you know, your program. I want to thank you for that. And I really appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome, Annabelle. You deserve it. You deserve to be on here. Well, Annabelle, I think that was great that you did that for Chris, you know, because like you said, a lot of people don't celebrate their lives while they're here. They wait till they pass away.
That's right.
I'm sure it meant a lot to Chris because, you know, as much as Chris has done in his life and all he's accomplished, when you get older and you're by yourself, especially when you're in a nursing home, I mean, it's got to bring you down. You know, you got to feel really bad. And
yes,
to get a visit from all his friends and to get these letters from these champions, I mean, at least it reminded him, not that he didn't know that, but it reminded him how well thought of he is and what a real champion he is and how we all
are. Absolutely. Yes. And let me tell you, when I do things like this, I think about myself. And I say, how would I feel if somebody did something like that for me if I was in that situation?
Right.
You know, and I make sure that what I do and say, it does that, it helps that person. It's not about me. You know, this is about Chris, you know. And I know that when I air that that meeting and that video, I was gonna get bombarded. I've been getting bombarded. You know, I mean, it's like people from all over the world.
Yeah.
Puerto Rico, from all over, writing, you know. I know people try to praise me, and I know you people are grateful, but it's not about me. It's about Chris.
Right.
It's about Chris.
Right. Yeah. Well, I was really impressed with how he looked. He was very well spoken, and
very
articulate, you know, so he looked like he was in really good spirits.
He had a lot. He had fun. He answered questions. He said his jokes, you know, and that was more like Chris that day. I was not sure. I was not sure who I was going to see. Because sometimes when he's not feeling well, I said, I just might go there with all these people. And he'll decide not to get out of bed.
Yeah, yeah.
Because, the nurses there, when I spoke to them, they told me, I said, he has days that nobody makes him get out of bed.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and I said, well, I'm going to take a chance on this, you know, and see, and hopefully everything will go well. And thanks God it did. It was successful.
Yeah. And Bill, how old did you say Chris is going to be this year?
He's going to be, Chris' birthday and mine are in the same month.
Oh, okay. August.
And years back when we were together, every year we used to celebrate our birthdays together.
Mm-hmm.
And have pictures of like that. And we always celebrated the birthday at my home. So Chris is about 4 years older than me. I can't remember the exact date. I know that my birthday is August 24, and he's just a few days later.
Okay.
But I'm going to, you know, check my calendar and find out for sure. And I will post his birthday too. So, you know, I'll be speaking to him hopefully over the weekend. And it's very difficult to speak with Chris over the phone.
Mm-hmm.
Very difficult. When I call him, he's got difficulties hearing. And every time I call him, for some reason, we cannot hold a full conversation.
Okay. Yeah.
And he gets frustrated because, you know, I'm speaking to him and he can't hear me. You know, sometimes he hears what I say, sometimes he doesn't. And I hear him very well.
Yeah.
Well, sometimes he doesn't have the phone near him. And it is, like you were saying, Annabelle, sometimes it's very frustrating. I was calling Chris like 3-4 times a week, and I might get through once.
Mm, that's
sometimes
me too.
He just doesn't with answer me. The phone, and he tells me the phone is far from him. But, you know, if he kept it, I mean, you know, whenever you're hospitalized, all you want is a phone call, you know, pass the days. And you know, I said, well, Chris, you know, keep it by your side. Or he says, hard to get to, it's hard to reach. I said, well, you know, get one of the nurses to help you. You know, that's frustrating because he couldn't talk to him very often.
Yeah. Well, the last visit that I had before this meeting that I went to see him, I asked him, what's the problem with the phone when I call you and we can have a conversation? He has the phone. The phone is hooked up to his left side.
So right.
He has problems reaching. He has to reach with his right arm to get the phone across his body. And I saw him trying to do that, and he was having difficulties picking up that phone and holding on to it, you know. So I really don't know. I don't know. I don't know if it's his hearing or what the situation is with that. But it's like you said, I out of 3 or 4 times that I call him, I may be able to speak with him a little bit, you know, once.
Yeah, yeah. Annabelle, do you think you're going to plan another trip up there with some of his friends again?
A lot of people asking me that now. And I'm thinking about that, doing it again. I will have to speak to the nursing home again.
Okay.
And see if I could arrange something and get a nice group, because I know that you want to go. I know that Richard Baldwin wants to go.
Yeah.
And a lot of other guys, bodybuilders, you know. This was a short notice thing. I did this like from 1 week, you know, in 2 weeks notice, you know, which is not a lot. But I'm sure that if I let Lee Haney know some time, you know, Lee Haney is in Georgia, right?
Yeah, Atlanta.
You know, and I'll let Boyer Cole know on time. We might be able to. What I would like to do is the following, Bill, and since you brought it up, is to get a good group of you guys together. You know, you and all these past people that competed with Chris, and maybe have a get together out here.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Have them travel out here to Florida and probably spend a good day together, you know.
Yeah, that'd be awesome.
What I'm going to try to do is to see if we could get Chris out to join us outside.
Yeah.
Hopefully by then, you know, this COVID thing is dying out now, so we might be able to get away with doing that. But let me work on that and see if we could something together like that. This way, people who are traveling a distance from out of Florida will make the trip worth a while out here.
Yeah. Maybe sometime.
Have a dinner together and things like
that. Yeah, that'd be awesome. That'd be great. Yeah.
What do you think?
Yeah, that'd be great.
So I will keep you posted on that and Bill also, so we could put this together. What do you think, Bill?
Yeah, that sounds great. Yeah, that would be terrific. Have a big outing.
I'm gonna start working on that and give it a lot of time and give people time to prepare for it.
Yeah.
Then we need to find a place where we could get together. Then I, at the same time, I will speak to the nursing home. I know a lady there that one of the attendants, she was the one that helped me put this together, to see if it would be possible to take Chris out and spend a day with us, that we don't have to stay in the nursing home.
Yeah.
You know, Annabelle, there's a restaurant right near there that Chris and I used to go to quite often called Peter Pan Restaurant. And it's less than a mile from there. And really? I know they could accommodate us. Yeah, I'm sure.
Okay. I'll be contacting you about that as I begin to work on that idea. Okay.
Because I think it's got to be somewhere close to the center, you know. And this place is a mile away. And it's got plenty of room. Big restaurant. Yeah.
Perfect. Awesome.
Perfect. Sounds good to me.
All right. All right, guys, thank you for joining me on the show. I really wanted to find out how this meeting went with Chris. I was sorry I couldn't make it, Annabelle, but thanks for inviting me. Like you said, it was just kind of short notice for me getting off work. But glad you guys had a great experience going out there and meeting with Chris. And hopefully we can do it all again. Because like you said, Annabelle,
absolutely,
it's important to celebrate
this
guy, you know, a great champion that he was, and let him know that he's still loved and missed by the bodybuilding community. So we got to give him his support while he's still here, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. Yes. Thank you, Bill. Thank you, John, for this opportunity. And I know Chris will be very happy to know all this.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, Bill. All right.
Take care. Thank you
very much for joining me. And I appreciate you guys coming on the show. And I'd love to have you guys back on the show again, because you guys both got a lot of bodybuilding knowledge and history behind you.
Thanks for having us, John. It's a real pleasure.
Absolutely. Pleasure to talk to both of you guys.
Great to see you, John.
All right, great to see you too, Bill. Take care,
Adam. Take care.
All right, see you guys. All right, thanks for listening to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Thanks to our sponsor, Florida Alternative Medicine, for sponsoring this episode. And thanks again up to all you guys who helped to contribute to the show on Patreon. If anyone out there is interested in doing that, you can just go to the official website, which is bodybuildinglegendsshow.com, and you'll see right there in the upper right-hand corner the link for Patreon. All right, so before I let you guys go, I'm going to read this article, a famous article by Jack Neary about the 1980 Mr. Olympia. If those of you who were not around the sport in 1980, you'll get a chance to hear this famous article. So it's titled Olympia Report, Arnold's Victory Creates Controversy and Bitterness by Jack Neary. Arnold Schwarzenegger's comeback resulted in a 7th Olympia victory, but many expert observers felt his victory was a miscarriage of justice and a setback for the sport. All right, here it is.
How many times had the rumor been dredged up? How long had it drifted aimlessly through the gossip wards of bodybuilding like some sun-baked tumbleweed rolling down a windswept road to nowhere? How often had Jim Walls echoed the anticipation of Arnold Schwarzenegger's return from retirement? And how often had Arnold himself told us, no, no, 1,000 times no, he was out to pasture to stay? Oh, there was talk 2 years ago of a special winner-take-all $100,000 match with rival Lou Ferrigno at Las Vegas, but that's all it was, talk. Life in the fast lane made for a contented Arnold, too busy chatting it up with the likes of Andy Warhol and Jackie O to callous his meaty palms with the knurling of a barbell. 5 years of retirement, the seminars, the endless tours to promote the books, the TV and movie acting, the contest promotion, etc., had left the mighty Arnold less massive and muscular than we'd known him. The once sharp, angular lines of his face softened. The great bulk, once carried in such a princely manner, shrank. His deltoids lost some of their coconut shape. The grapefruit-sized biceps atrophied to two-thirds their former dimension. The once powerful thighs could barely add substance to the legs of his trousers. The king had abdicated. A few weeks before the 16th IFBB Mr. Olympia contest last October in Sydney, Australia, the rumor of the Austrian Oaks' return to competition surfaced again. He had been training with feverish intensity for 7 weeks at Santa Monica's World Gym. After 3 years of political infighting among the studio bosses, production for the long-awaited $15 million film Conan the Barbarian was underway. The film's star was needed in the kind of condition that brought him his ego-soothing string of 6 Olympia titles. Within a few weeks, Arnold's body was firming up and growing at an alarming rate. It was almost changing its form before the very eyes of the men who trained around him every morning. A week before the biggest bodybuilding contest ever, some $50,000 in prize money, people close to the scene were talking seriously of a last-second entrant, Arnold himself. He was 85% a week ago, photographer John Balick told us en route to Sydney 6 days before the event. He hasn't looked this good since he retired. He's 225 and cut. Ken Waller, back from retirement himself, had his own theory about Arnold competing. Just think about this. First place this year is $20,000. Arnold's got to be getting at least that for doing the color commentary for CBS. What's he going to do? Come back, risk losing and destroying the legend, or just sit back and announce on TV for the same money? He's in good shape, but not like he used to be. People don't remember how he really was. The day before the contest was depressingly bleak and quiet in Sydney. The bodybuilders, great head-turning attractions to the awe-stricken souls of Bondi Beach, withdrew to the security of their hotel rooms, which emanated the pungent odor of suntan. Every TV set in Bondi's Cosmopolitan Inn was tuned to the Muhammad Ali-Larry Holmes fight, beamed live from Las Vegas. Mike Mentzer, Boyer Coe, Danny Padilla, Ken Waller, all of bodybuilding's best sat in the privacy of their rooms watching the world's most famous man reeling from the club-like jab of his attacker make the biggest mistake of his life, go for that last hurrah. Across Sydney, amid the palatial comfort of his Hilton suite, Arnold also viewed the carnage on his TV screen with more than a little interest. How often has he been called the Muhammad Ali of bodybuilding? The outcome of this fight had a special significance to him. On the eve of his return from 5 years of bodybuilding idleness, Arnold's mind began to compose an unpleasant scenario. With each punch Holmes ripped into the puffy mess that was Ali's face, Arnold winced, not out of sympathy for the boxer, but for the imagined vision of a similar fate at the hands of his opponents the next day. Arnold would talk of the fight later. You hear the stories of old guys, the former champs, coming back and getting wiped out by the new guys. And it was happening to Ali right before my eyes. Just like me, he decided to come back one more time. I could see he was making a mistake. And for a split second, I had to wonder if I'd be making the same mistake by entering the Olympia the next day. Would I be risking my legend? But it was only for a split second. The thing that got Ali and me where we are is that our decisions are gut reactions. They're instinctive. Suddenly, boom, it's there. It's as if a higher power took over your mind. So you go after whatever you're after 100%. I never questioned my competing. If I had, I would have realized it was a very dangerous thing to do. One of the judges, Belgium's Jacques Bloemhart, was aware of the danger the morning before the Olympia. He saw Arnold training at the gym, and later that day told us, I saw him. Nothing. People who don't know how he used to look are impressed, but he doesn't have it. He shouldn't enter this contest. It'll be a mistake. I remember when his pecs were so monstrous, you could stand underneath them in the rain and not get wet. His chest was like a shelf over your head. But Blumhardt was one of the few to see Arnold before the contest. Certainly none of the other 15 competitors were aware of Arnold's condition. Most of them didn't even know he'd be competing. Some didn't care. I'm sick of hearing all this talk about Arnold competing, contender Mike Mentzer told us that dismal day of Ali's demise. I couldn't care less if he enters. But I'll tell you one thing. What a feather in my cap to beat Arnold if he enters. There was no small number of people who thought Mentzer could do it, too. After placing second to three-time champ Frank Zane the year before, Mentzer vowed 1980 would be his year. He trained with savage intensity, beginning his Spartan regimen almost 6 months before the battle. Unlike the previous year, Mentzer entered no other contest, saving his efforts for the big one, the Sydney Olympia. In the course of his training, he added an incredible 10 pounds of muscle since his first Olympia in 79, and it didn't take an expert's eye to see that he had equaled, if not surpassed, the level of definition and muscularity he had amazed observers with before. 3 months before the contest, Mentzer read an alarming passage written by Arnold in Muscle Mag International. In a near malicious attack on Mentzer, Arnold wrote that his rival did not possess even, quote, a world-class physique, unquote, and that the Olympia was one title that would forever elude him. This from a man who at the time was stated to be a judge at the most important contest of Mentzer's life. How can Arnold possibly judge me objectively after making comments such as these, Mentzer wanted to know at the time the attack was published. Indeed, there was no denying the fact that Arnold saw Mentzer as an upstart, a parvenu, a person who had suddenly gained status and wealth in the sport by way of a formidable physique and a superior intellect. Arnold saw Mentzer as a threat to his lofty position as the sport's king. The threat may have been very real, for it was Mentzer who, in his training seminars explaining his revolutionary heavy-duty system, often pointed to the fallacies of 20-plus sets per body part, the very methods that catapulted Arnold to the top. If you can all achieve the physique of Arnold by using his training system, why aren't there more Arnolds running around? Mentzer often asked his students. Surprisingly, such criticism of Arnold's training was taken personally by Arnold. He would carry a grudge a long time. After the Olympia, defending champ Frank Zane would ask Arnold why he came back to compete, and Arnold would tell him to get back at Mentzer and Boyer Co. to show them they can't get away with knocking me in my training. Arnold would admit to saying this later. Yes, at first, that was one of the reasons why I wanted to compete. This game is too small to knock each other. I wanted to show Mentzer and Co. that you could go into the Olympia on a very positive note without criticizing others, and win. That was my motivation at first, but finally it meant nothing to me. Zane had reason to believe Arnold had it in for him, too. After his 1979 victory at Columbus, Ohio, Zane was asked by Arnold on nationwide TV how it felt to win a third Olympia. The former schoolteacher stunned the interviewer when he replied, "Great, Arnold, almost as good as the time I beat you in 68. One does not do that to the Austrian Oak and escape the consequences. In retrospect, Zane is convinced of that. There are those who wondered why Zane, too, would risk his standing in the sport for a fourth title shot. He had nothing to gain and everything to lose. As his preparations for the contest unfolded, things began to go awry. There were warnings of defeat he wouldn't heed. While tanning at the poolside of his Palm Springs home, Zane suffered a freak accident when the chair he was sitting in collapsed. The accident sent him to the hospital for 8 days with internal bleeding. I knew after I had my accident that something was wrong with this contest, he said later. It was off to a bad start, and I should have stayed out. It was a warning I didn't heed. Then there was Boyer Co., the other target of Arnold's wrath. He had never felt better about his chances for victory. Some 10 pounds heavier this time, he shocked observers at Paul Graham's gym in Sydney with his advanced muscularity. He talked about his attitude 2 days before the contest while basking in the glorious Australian sunshine. I feel great. Jet lag is no problem with me. I've done a lot of travel, and this contest is just too important to let feeling tired affect me. I've been having terrific workouts since I arrived. I'm in the best shape I've ever been in, heavier and harder. I injured my shoulder after the 79 Canada Cup, and it lingered for a few months. I trained around it. Then on June 1st, the first day of my Olympia preparation, it started to improve. I began handling heavier weights and doing less sets. Every workout was better than the last, and before long, I was simply in the best shape of my life. I feel very confident about this contest. I have it all together. I'm not nervous at all. It's pointless to get nervous now. If you aren't ready when you get on the plane to come over here, you'll never be ready. Chris Dickerson knew that. When he made the 18-hour flight from Los Angeles with the rest of bodybuilding superstars, he was quietly confident of victory. He had maintained the form that won him the vaunted Grand Prix title of 1980. He had entered no less than 6 contests, and each time out, he was in his best possible shape. Dickerson and Zane maintained the lowest profiles in the days leading up to the contest. Upon his arrival at the Sydney airport, Zane was immediately and almost mysteriously spirited away to a private residence. He would remain incognito until the morning of the contest. Dickerson, after an evening at the Cosmopolitan Inn, where the majority of the competitors stayed, made tracks downtown to the more comfortable environs of the Hilton. Dennis Tinerino did the same. Tinerino had a lot riding on this contest. His manager, Ken Mears, had invested a great deal of money in him. Both men held very high hopes. They had good reason. Only a week before, Joe Weider raved about the transplanted Brooklynite's super muscular condition. There was, in the opinion of some, a very real chance Tinerino would win his first Olympia. Other bodybuilders shared those ambitions. Only a few had shown up in less than top condition. For all of the competitors, the one thought that was uppermost in their minds as they went to bed that Olympia Eve was, "Tomorrow is my day." Each of them would be in for a very large disappointment. Tomorrow would be nobody's day but Arnold's. There is something indescribable about the electric excitement of an Olympia morning. In the hours leading up to it, sleep, if it comes at all, is punctuated by a fluctuation between a half-dream state and the foggy awareness that something of great importance is imminent. Yet no one who has experienced the adrenaline-fueled high of an Olympia morning ever rises from that shallow sleep tired. Dawn broke early Saturday, October 4th, in Sydney. The sky was clear. Most of the competitors were awake with anticipation by the time the sun ascended from the watery horizon east of Bondi Beach. For Mike Mentzer, there was still some to be done in preparation for the prejudging scheduled for 2 p.m. In training for this, his second Olympia, had been a devastating ordeal that had left him huge and defined, but tired beyond exhaustion. He had said days before the contest, "I like bodybuilding, but I like living better. I'm never putting my mind and body through this hell again." There was no sign of his fatigue Olympia morning. The day before, he had been concerned about a small amount of water he was holding subcutaneously. As a means of ridding himself of the bothersome fluid, Mentzer borrowed a rubber sweatsuit from Samir Banud. Wearing that and a regular cotton jogging suit, he locked himself in the kitchen of his hotel room. Then he turned on the oven and stove, full blast, creating a sauna effect of awesome intensity. To make sure that he'd be completely dehydrated, the perspiring giant endured 45 minutes of this. The sweat literally cascaded from every pore until there was a large puddle that on the linoleum floor. Throughout this ordeal, Mentzer kept swallowing potassium tablets to prevent his muscles from becoming too drained. While he was anxious to purge himself of the water beneath the skin, he needed the water in his muscles to keep his size at a maximum. Potassium would do that. Little did Mentzer know that on the same day, Arnold subjected himself to a similar ritual. Indeed, Arnold's need to free himself from his cloak of water was so desperate, he went through his posing routine no less than 50 times. Why was he holding water? Before leaving for Australia, Arnold had taken a cortisone shot to ease the pain of a shoulder injury and allow him to continue training. A side effect of the shot was extreme water retention. As an extra precaution, Mentzer sat in his makeshift sauna the morning of the Olympia. It was then that a very excited Samir called the room. It seems, in his own bizarre way of shedding subcutaneous water, Samir took a Lasix tablet, a very strong and sometimes unpredictable diuretic, that not only promotes a veritable Niagara of urine, but dangerously steals the body of its minerals, particularly potassium. And that's bad news for the heart. That was exactly the news Samir was frantically telling Mentzer. His heart was in the throes of an arrhythmic tap dance. On Mentzer's advice, we were dispatched immediately to Samir's room with a handful of potassium tablets. A scared but grateful Samir answered the door. Within minutes, his crisis had passed. Poor Samir. There was a man who had been preoccupied with losing water for nearly a month. "The Lebanese lion is going to be the atomic bomb in Australia," he boasted on the flight over. "I'm holding a little water now, but as soon as I lose it, look out." During a stopover at the Honolulu International Airport, while everyone was trying to catch a few winks in a most uncomfortable environment, Samir quietly stole away to a public washroom where, in hope of sweating more water, he posed before a mirror for 30 minutes. When someone asked him his whereabouts, John Balik replied, "He's in the washroom trying to squeeze out a little more water." We laughed. Samir's personal crusade to break the bondage of H2O had become a bit of a joke among certain members of our entourage. Mensah said, "I've been hearing about this water for 8 months. I'm waiting to see him lose it." "Well, he's oceans away," your reporter responded. It would not be the last of the puns concerning Samir's water. Flying back to Los Angeles, Samir expressed dismay over his puffy, waterlogged condition at the contest. "If I only had a few more days of sweating," he lamented, "it would have been different." Again, we could not resist needling the hapless rookie. "Samir, it means nothing now. It's all water under the bridge." The following conversation between two fellows was overheard in an elevator of the Cosmopolitan Inn 2 hours before the prejudging. "So, you figure Arnold will get blown off the stage?" "Yeah, he's making a mistake this time, just like Ali. He's not going up against the jerks he used to. I think Mensah will destroy him." There was an air of great importance as all the competitors, judges, officials, and various parties with fingers on the pulse of the game assembled in the poorly lit, low-ceilinged room deep in the carpeted catacombs below the famous Sydney Opera House. An ultimatum in the form of a petition had been put before IFBB President Ben Weider and Chief Judge Bill Pearl. He would not judge that day. It read, quote, "The following Mr. Olympia competitors are in favor of abolishing the two weight classes, under and over 200 pounds, and replacing them with one open class," unquote. The signatures of all the competitors were scrawled beneath, all competitors except Arnold. The message in the petition was implicit: one class or no contest. The potentially explosive situation had to be defused. Pearl took control. "I'm not the man to make the decision, but someone here will have to," he told us. "I'm not saying Arnold's right or Arnold's wrong, but something must be done to satisfy the 15 other bodybuilders." Then Pearl, who had nobly removed himself from the judging panel because he had spent time in his Oregon ranch coaching Chris Dickerson, struck a blow for the petitioners. "If we keep two classes, do we really know the best six men will be among the finalists?" Heads nodded. That was the crux of the problem. If the top three from each class were picked to form the six finalists, who was to say the fourth place man in the under 200 pound class wasn't better than any of the over 200 pound class competitors, or vice versa? Boyer Coe, who spearheaded the drive for one class, called upon the one bodybuilder who opposed the change. It would be the last of common courtesy we'd see that morning. Arnold was given the floor. He would not surrender it before things turned ugly. "The reason I want to keep classes," Arnold began, "is because when the Olympia was started in 1965, we did have one class. Everybody competed against everybody else. And for years, it was that way. Then the shorter men complained they weren't getting a fair chance because they had to go head-to-head with the big guys right from the start. So in 1974, we changed to two classes to protect the small man. What's the sense in changing back? Are we going to change every time someone doesn't like the rules?" "But Arnold," Coe tried to respond. But Arnold, as we said, had the floor. Condescending was the tone of his barbarian. "Excuse me, Boyer. Let's talk like adults here and let me finish, okay?" The hostility in Arnold's eyes fairly leapt at his stunned competitor. The same anger would surface again. "I just don't see what the big deal is," Arnold continued. "The purpose of this contest is to pick the number one bodybuilder in the world. Not second, not third. No matter how many classes we've had, the best man has always won. All that matters is the winner." It was a viewpoint no one else in the room shared. A voice from the assemblage sounded out. "Not all of us can win the Olympia, so it's important to know where we stand. Some of us would like to know how we compare." This humble plea was not without its silent message, too. Placings are crucial. They are needed for the allocation of prize money. Every man in the room knew this. Money is as much the bottom line as his first place. Arnold was unbending in his attitude. "We aren't here to pick second. We're here to pick first. Why change the one class?" It was Mensah's turn to enter the fray. "Besides the fact that everybody but one guy wants one class, it's obvious that running a contest with just one group as opposed to two is a lot faster and easier, Arnold. If there's a better, more efficient way, why not change?" And then, as if a straight question were not deserving of a straight answer, Arnold's true contempt for his rival flowed forth with the following irrelevant remark. "Mike Mensah, We all know Zane beat you last year because you have a big stomach. The room froze, save Mensur, who rose defiantly from his seat 20 feet from his attacker. There was more on his mind than just words. "You're the one who said we should talk like adults, and you bring it down to this personal level," Mensur snapped as he approached Arnold, finger pointing menacingly. Before Arnold's lean face could be turned into a gory pulp, Ben Weider moved swiftly to intercept Mensur. In a moment, sure violence was averted. Arnold turned away smugly. Mensur took his seat beside his companion, Kathy Gelfo, who, if she were so blessed with the strength, would have single-handedly torn Arnold's head from the massive body that held it high. Bodybuilding had just taken a quantum leap backward. The debate continued with minor players. It was then Joe Weider's turn to lend his calm influence. He pulled Arnold aside and said, "Why wreck the whole contest for everyone if the best man's going to win anyway?" As quickly as Arnold brought the meeting to the edge of violence, he allayed the tension with a tense, "Joe just said something to me and I agree with him. Why should I spoil it for 15 guys? I withdraw my objection." "The IFBB is here to protect the bodybuilder," Ben Weider said, trying to appeal to the jangled senses of the congregation. "And we are here to see the rules are uniform. So under extreme circumstances, we're making the change to one class here in the best interest of the bodybuilders." Arnold needed the last word. He walked over to Ben, shook his hand, and said sardonically, "I want to thank you, Ben, for your support, and I want to prove one way or the other the best man will win tonight." As a diplomatic gesture to Arnold, Ben called for a round of applause. Most hands remained still. The damage had been done. Before the meeting adjourned, Bill Pearl asked the competitors if there were any complaints regarding the judges. Reg Park, Mitz Kawashima, Albert Busack, Dan Howard, Brendan Ryan, Jacques Blumhardt, and Mike Walczak. No one uttered a peep. Not then, anyway. As this is being written, it's a full month since the physically reincarnated Arnold Schwarzenegger, with a mere 8 weeks of training invested in history's most famous body, strode cockily on stage and added one more Olympia title to his superfluous string of six. A full month and still not settled was the emotional dust sent high from what one vanquished competitor described as the most outrageous decision in the history of bodybuilding. To the furious 15, united in the belief that the wrong man won, the 1980 Mr. Olympia contest remains a bitter pill, lodged uncomfortably in the gullet. To the Austrian Oak, his most recent victory was just a day a month ago. Now my mind is on other projects. The instant Arnold stepped on stage with his 15 opponents, it was apparent to this reporter that he had made a mistake. Arnold himself would tell us later, "Look, I know I was only in 90% shape. I could look in the mirror and see that. I couldn't fool myself." Arnold at 90% is a formidable sight indeed. The biceps are peaked and mighty, the chest full and imposing, but Arnold at 90% is 10% less than his best, and that gives breathing room to his weaknesses. Slender thighs, underdeveloped triceps and deltoids, and a mediocre midsection. All of those flaws distracted from the package in a most unflattering way. And in the opinion of this reporter, Arnold's weakness only served to strengthen the incredible condition of the men who looked better. Chris Dickerson, Boyer Coe, and Mike Mensur. There are those that would put Frank Zane in that group. In order of appearance, here's how they looked. 1, Danny Padilla. If and when the giant killer ever decides to really put it all together, we will see, in spite of his height, the first Puerto Rican Mr. Olympia. In Australia, Danny had his usual beautiful shape and mass, but because of a week-long bout with hemorrhoids and diarrhea, the smoky-eyed fire plug was anything but ripped. 2, Boyer Coe. No one thought he could improve about his astounding condition of 1979, but he did. And how? Boyer was absolutely out of this world. For the first time, he weighed more than 200 pounds and was almost two cut. His posing routine to Rocky II was one of the finest ever. He had a repertoire of poses, mostly arm shots, that's beyond compare. 3, Roy Duvall. The first Olympia for the Briton. He had a very well-proportioned physique, and his posing to Emerson, Lake, and Palmer's version of Fanfare for the Common Man was stirring, but he looked too puffy to be a threat. 4, Arnold Schwarzenegger. I've long been one of the Oak's most vocal fans. In the history of bodybuilding, only one man could compare with Arnold, Sergio Oliva. But Arnold had the smarts to easily handle the Cuban. Regardless of how highly I've regarded Arnold in the past, the 34-year-old just didn't look like number one that day in Sydney. His posing had the leonine grace and power, but it seemed uninspired and old hat. It's a mystery to me how Arnold could command a perfect 100 score in the mandatory posing round. To score perfectly, one would have to be perfect in each pose. Regardless of the fact that Arnold neglected to do some of the compulsory poses, those he did do showed he needed another 2, maybe 3 weeks of training to be considered the best on that stage. 5, Roger Walker. Unquestionably the most improved bodybuilder in the contest. Thick and striated beyond description, this hometown favorite drew, understandably, the biggest ovation of the day. Walker is very definitely Mr. Olympia material. 6, Roy Callender. The biggest man in the contest. No one sports more muscle than this Montreal resident. But, alas, he wasn't in the diamond heart condition we've seen him in before and was quickly relegated to next year country. He would narrowly lose a tie with Walker. 7, Mike Mentzer. What can be said about a colossus who scored a perfect 300 in 1979 and looked even better in 1980? It is inconceivable that bodybuilding's most intelligent practitioner can get any larger. But the detail was there this time. He may have had the best midriff in the whole contest. 8, Tony Emmett. This hardworking, quiet Yorkshireman had some bum decisions before, but this time he looked a little overtrained. His back was still one of the best I've seen. 9, Ken Waller. He wouldn't have competed had he not told Paul Graham, the promoter, 8 months before that he'd be there. This was not the real Ken Waller. He was huge, but fat went out with Louis Cyr. 10, Samir Banu. Who has better shape and symmetry? Samir is probably the greatest young contender, and the title is very definitely within his reach. But he was a good 2 weeks away from being cut. Water wasn't his problem. It was fat. 11, Frank Zane. It's a miracle the defending champ got into the shape he did, considering the severity of his injury in Palm Springs. He was the most defined man on stage, but it was obvious he was playing catch-up following the setback. He just didn't have the muscle size to pull it off. His posing to Pink Floyd was surpassed only by the next competitor. 12, Chris Dickerson. Coming off his impressive string of Grand Prix victories, Chris couldn't have looked more polished and tighter. So passionate was his posing to Dionne Warwick's Never Love This Way Again that even his staunchest rivals were prompted to elicit praise. The only man other than Arnold to receive first place votes in the final pose down. 13, Dennis Tinerino. The pre-contest hoopla in favor of the big Italian was considerable. A lot of people, after seeing him in the weeks leading up to the contest, were certain Dennis was the man to beat. And he was great, very tight, but he still needs work in too many areas. 14, Tom Platz. Worked maniacally year-round to bring his upper body almost up to par with the best legs in the sport. And he was ripped. Made his presence felt in a very positive way. Give him a few years. 15, Casey Viator. More was expected of this monster. There are few men with more muscle than this Cajun, but you just can't win a thing if you can't see the physique for the fat. He'll be back. One of the few guys capable of winning this title. 16, Ed Corney. Last but not least, when you're 47 years old, just showing up on stage and holding your own against men young enough to be your sons is a victory of sorts. Still has the formidable development, and you can't pose better than Ed. You can only do it differently. Too puffy this time. And then they have the scores here. Schwarzenegger got a 300. Dickerson got 292. Zane got 291. Coe got 280. Mentzer got 278. Walker, 277. Callender, 277. And then after that, 8th went to Tinerino. 9th, Platz. 10th, Padilla. 11th, Corney. 12th, Emmett. 13th, Duvall. 14th, Viator, 15th, Banute, and 16th, Waller. Something started to smell when Mentzer was announced as the fifth-place finisher. How is it that the Mentzer of 1979 could score a perfect 300 and 1 year later, with 10 pounds more muscle and even tighter skin, score a mere 278? Fifth place? The judges had to be joking. So ludicrous was the decision, Mentzer said later, that really all I could do was laugh. I'll tell you, somebody out there really wanted me crushed out completely. Well, that's it for me. That's the last time I'm going through that kind of training for that kind of shit decision. No one can tell me I wasn't in the best shape of my life. My bodybuilding career is over. Bodybuilding just lost what could have been its best spokesman. If only I'd been given the chance. Boyer Coe's immediate reaction to 4th, again, who's kidding whom, was less civilized than Mentzer's appraisal of his own placing. Is there no justice? The enraged Coe demanded to know as he sent chairs flying into walls. Indeed, Coe's response was reminiscent of Dickens, who wrote in Great Expectations, "There is nothing so finely perceived and so finely felt as injustice." Zane, at first, accepted third with a calmer demeanor. Shortly after, however, he shattered his trophy into hundreds of pieces by hurling it to the asphalt of the Opera House parking lot. Dickerson accepted second place with a sharp, "Oh no," backstage, and after a curt smile on stage, he vanished into the night minutes later. It was a very big letdown, he would admit later. Arnold, of course, received his placing with a tad more enthusiasm. "I can't believe it," he roared backstage. "Seven times. I can't believe it." But with the announcement of Arnold's triumph, in the words of John Milton, all hell broke loose. For the first time in his heralded career, Arnold was booed by approximately 40% of the more than 2,000 fans who filled the posh seats of the Opera House. "Of course, I'd rather have no booing," he confided afterwards. "But I didn't come to worry about boos. I came to win. No decision is ever 100% popular." All 15 competitors are unanimous in their belief that selecting Arnold as 1980 Mr. Olympia was a bad decision on the part of the judges. They aren't alone in that opinion. The CBS sports crew on hand to cover the contest expressed shock at the results. They had, in anticipation of the predicted outcome, interviewed only two men backstage, Arnold, because he is, after all, Arnold, and Menser, the man they saw as the champion. Even Bill Pearl, known for his integrity as the IFBB's chief judge, said later, "I sure as hell wouldn't have picked Arnold." In the wake of his victory, Arnold is not pleased about the outcry from his colleagues. So strong are the feelings about the decision, a cabal of competitors, led by Frank Zane, Mike Menser, and Boyer Coe, boycotted Arnold's Pro Mr. Universe contest November 1st at Columbus, Ohio. "The old camaraderie of bodybuilding is gone," said Arnold. "People are now counting on contest money so much that when they don't get it, they get mad and call fix. The money aspect is ruining the game. In 1975, I said, wouldn't it be great if a bodybuilder could make a living just by competing? I have to go back on that. It's sad so many competitors have to rely on a sixth place finish in a contest to survive. And it's strange that a money-oriented man like me would be saying this. Money creates fights and greed. I trained for this contest with a joy. I didn't care about the money." So what was it that moved him to compete? "Well, I've been training hard for the film, and as the weeks passed, my training partner, Franco Colombo, kept saying, 'Arnold, the Olympia's coming up. You must go into it. It'd shock everybody.' At first, I resisted, but I began working it over in my mind, and I was hooked. I was getting bigger, and it felt terrific. So I sat down with my girlfriend, Maria Shriver. She told me not to compete, that the other guys respected me for going out on top. I could blow it. And I agreed with her, but this force within me kept telling me to compete. Maria said if I had so much excess energy, I should learn Spanish because the film is being shot near Madrid. But I said, I cannot let it go. Then one night she stopped, said she had given me reasons not to compete, but if I wanted to compete, she would support me. She's a powerhouse. She was the one who kept tearing the ice cream away from me." Answering the claims of poor judging, Arnold points out that all the competitors were asked if they approved the panel. "No one said a thing. I'm friendly with nearly every judge around, but the way the judges see a contest lineup has nothing to do with personal friendship. It's a whole new ballgame." Zane, Menser, Tinarino, Callender, and Coe are a few who, as of October 4th, are looking for a whole new ballgame. All have talked about retirement. Welcome to the 80s. All right. Great article by Jack Meary. I haven't read that article in a long time, so what a joy that was to read that again. That was a great article. All right, guys, that's it for our show this week. Hope you enjoyed it. We will be back next week, hopefully, with another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Stay safe out there. Enjoy your workouts, and we'll see you guys next week. Take care.